The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Greetings, nerds. This is Scene and Nerd. I'm your host, Sarah Belmont, and with me, as always, is our Mr. Producer, Will Polk. How are you doing tonight, Will?
Doing very, very well. Nice and relaxed and rejuvenated, so I'm ready to talk some new shows tonight.
So unfair. I'm, like, not feeling rejuvenated at all. I'm at, like, where you were probably a week or two ago, where you're like, I can see the vacation, it's just not here yet.
I was that way, definitely that way. It was nice to get out of Dodge and be away from pretty much all responsibilities, and the only responsibility I had was, like, okay, did I, like, pack the sunblock or not? And that was like the deepest thought I had.
Sunblock.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I guess it's an Alaskan thing. Like, who needs sunblock? You just go out.
You definitely need it when you're sitting on the coast. So but it was a good weekend. But I did watch Krypton while on break. Can't wait to talk to you about it.
Who didn't watch Krypton? I mean, more people need to watch this show because it's good. It's very good.
Yeah.
And I forgot about it. Like, I am surprised that I didn't go back, rewatch any of the first season episodes. And I was kind of getting anxious. I was like, is this going to be a bad idea to go into season 2, episode 1? And in it, like, the first 15 minutes, I spent a lot of time, like, wondering to myself, what the heck are they talking about? They've created an entire culture. And we're just going to jump into Krypton talk. I'm sorry. I can't help it.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm
It's Will's fault. He's like, let's talk Krypton. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I am the producer, so.
Well, they've created a Krypton as being a culture, basically a world. So there's a lot of lingo that you have to refamiliarize yourself with. So I spent that first 15 minutes just being a bit lost in translation, and then slowly things got placed back together. And then the moment when, spoiler alert, Seg and Adam reunite, that their chemistry makes this show for me.
Yeah.
I just love those two characters. Like, and I forgot, like, how much they're good, because even in season 1, they didn't have a lot of on-screen time together, because there was a lot of angst going on with some secrets and revelations. But in this episode, it's just like, no, this is your buddy cop. Like, these two people who in any other timeline would never be placed together are all of a sudden, like, dependent on one another, and they just bounce really well off of each other.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought their relationship up, because they truly are the heart of the show. Mm-hmm. It's their relationship. And I intended on rewatching season 1 to refresh my memory as far as what happened. I mean, I remember the end clearly, as far as Seg getting placed into the Phantom Zone by Val-El, his grandfather. And so I remember the basics of what happened with Seg and Brainiac's showdown at the end of the first season. You know, there were a lot of other plot points, like, for example, Vorax, yes, the son of Seg and Nyssa.
Mm-hmm.
I had forgotten about that, that they had that child, and also the fact that Nyssa was a clone. So there were some things that during the episode, whenever they were dropping lines of dialogue, things started coming back to me. But what I really liked about this show is it had a 6-month time jump. And I think some of the complaints about the first season was it took a while to build the world. With season two, it jumped right into the action.
Right.
And we don't have a lot of just general exposition. We really have a lot of energy out of the gate in this first episode.
Right. You know, it's funny because it caught me off guard how much we got placed right in the middle of action. Like for us, it's been 6 months, but for these characters, clearly not. I mean, they purposely in the last season took Adam out of the picture so that we could see this pilot through his eyes as he's just returning to Krypton in the past, having already visited the future of Earth, which, I mean, I immediately picked on the whole Nyssa kid clone thing. I forgot what they did with Adam. I was like, oh yeah. Yeah. And even the way they played it off, it made it seem like, oh, he was just going off and doing some rogue mission. Oh, that's right. Remember that time when he ended up on Earth again with a completely different future? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Baniac had conquered the Earth and Detroit is instead of the, we had the symbol of Zod, Drew Zod, in the middle of the town square, you know, kneel to Zod.
Right. It's not that Berniak conquered the Earth. Zod first took over, and then something happened where Berniak bottled up the Earth and added it on his whatever you want to call it, his gauntlet.
I see what you did there. Crossing universes.
What were your thoughts on, because, and I was worried about this. I really was. Another thing that caught me off guard was they did not spend an episode. They did not spend two episodes with Seg just being stuck in the Phantom Zone. Mm-hmm. They spent about 20 minutes.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure that's all I ever needed. And I'm really glad they did that. Not because it wasn't interesting, but because Seg is such a big part of, like, it's the main character.
Yeah.
You can only go so long without him. And they kind of scapegoated it because it's not that they immediately put him back on Krypton.
Nope.
But they maneuvered him out of that area. But just before we touch on that, visiting Brainiac's home planet, what are your thoughts on the way they made the Phantom Zone appear?
You know, that is a good question. We see various iterations of the Phantom Zone. It was the Christopher Reeve Superman movies. The Phantom Zone was this basically large we weren't in it, but we saw Zod and the other two criminals caught in the Phantom Zone in a basically like crystal shield that was twirling through space. And then I think in Man of Steel, when Zod was captured in it, it was this big device sucking him up in it. So this is our first time in it. Mm-hmm. And it was visually, I thought, man, they got an increase in the budget for season two. but it was otherworldly. I think they did a good job of conveying that it is a dimension outside of normal space time. But I agree with your point that I'm glad they did not belabor Seg being in the Phantom Zone for, you know, longer than absolutely necessary, because we know he's been in there and they don't really need to spend any more screen time with him being in there. In the time that they showed him during the first episode of season two, it conveyed basically what he's been experiencing the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm. I really liked the speed of Phantom Zone. Like, not just, like, hearsay is, they get out, whatever. But they're the constant movement in that area, which, to your point, it really highlights that this is outside of natural space and time. And now the question is, did the writers just give away the ending of season two? I mean, what I understood is that moment when Seg is standing there and he sees Elida and he sees Zod strangling her. Mm-hmm. Is that how this season is going to end? Because Brainiac, I believe, is the one who alludes that that's a vision of the future.
He did. He did.
And also, Zod, I thought you were smart. Doesn't she need to be alive to have you?
it's our Flash paradoxes. Here we go.
I mean, did you not watch Back to the Future while you were on Earth? I mean, come on, it's a classic.
Yeah. Well, they did have their Marty McFly moment last season, where they did have the cape, Superman's cape, mm-hmm. do the Marty McFly, and then of course it regenerated itself whenever they set us quote the timeline, I guess. Reset the timeline.
And then
it became the flag of Zod. So, time travel always gives me a headache.
Well, I mean, to your point, like, clearly the writers are big fans of that particular franchise because this is just another thing that they're introducing. Like, they're not going to have the cape this season, but this premonition or foreshadowing of events to come and the time paradox that could occur. I mean, I would be curious to know if the writers, if they're doing that on purpose.
I think they are.
Every season you should be on the lookout for a reference to something Back to the Future related.
Yeah, I think they are. This is a very intentional thing to basically use those old time travel tropes that we've seen in other shows and basically, given that this is a prequel and we as the viewer knows what is to come as far as Seg basically having, Jor-El and then of course Jor-El having Kal-El. So all that has been turned upside down in this show now. Because, for example, with Nyssa having Vorex, is he going to be rechristened Jor-El at some point? Or is Nyssa and Seg going to have Jor-El? Or will Seg and Lytha Zod being Jor-El's mother? I mean, there's just so many ways that these arcs can go. And I think what I like about this show is that, okay, we, given that we know what our future is supposed to be, and especially in this universe, Adam Strange is the person who is the knower of that. We don't know. I mean, you're right. That vision that Seg saw in the Phantom Zone could be the outcome that will come to pass, mm-hmm. but it could be something completely else.
Right. Another thing that confounded me was all of this grandfather, grandson, grand, great grandfather stuff that they keep throwing out there. Cause I got confused. At one point, I seriously wanted to pause the show and sketch out a family tree.
Yeah.
Because I'll be honest, I don't really know who, like the birth order of what leads us to the end product of Kal-El.
Okay.
I don't know that. However, it gets really confusing when you have a child, a literal baby, a newborn, mm-hmm. referred to by a giant older man as, oh, he's my great grandfather. He belongs with me. Creepy. First of all, very, very creepy. No. And also, how many greats did you add to that? Because later on in the episode, I believe Adam refers to Kal-El almost as Seg's grandson. And I'm like, wait a second.
That's correct.
Okay. So, So did Zod mess up? I mean, is him being in the past messing with his head or something? Because I could have sworn he referred to the child as his great-great-grandfather.
Let's see. So let's just get the L timeline first as far as family tree. So Val-El is Kyle Superman's great-great-grandfather. Then Seg is Val-El's daughter married Seg's father. And then Seg is Val-El's grandson.
Right.
And then Jor-El is Seg's son.
Okay.
And then Kal-El, who's Superman, is Seg's grandson. So, yeah, okay. So Val-El is Kal-El's great-great-grandfather.
Right, I understand that.
Yeah.
But then why did Zod refer to Vor-X as being related to Zod when in this reality, yeah, Zod and
So Drew Zod and Seg are, I mean, Drew Zod is Seg and Life is Zod's son.
Right, right.
So.
The half brother. Right.
Half brother of Vor-X.
Yeah. Still, I stand by this statement until the listener, like, proves me wrong. I could have sworn he said great-great-grandfather. So, you know, Vor-X, technically, is a kid. It's a child. We protect children. However, he's unrelated in this family drama.
Right. Well, I know I guess Drew Zod was going to adopt him if Nyssa didn't follow his orders to basically try to root out the rest of the resistance. He was basically
the future.
Right.
Will, really should not be adopting anyone.
Yeah, he should not be. He's definitely, we're definitely into the Avengers Endgame timelines here now.
Oh man. Let's jump to another bad guy who we saw a lot of. And I will be honest with you, when they introduced Brainiac in the later half of season one, he was creepy. Like, it was his presence that was very, oh, this is somebody we have to be fearful of. And I didn't really understand his character until this episode. Because that exchange between him and Seg is just underneath my favorite moment of the show beyond, and right above it is the Adam and Seg scenes, but right below it is that whole exchange between Brainiac and Seg and you need me, I need you, so let's do this, even though we're gonna always end up fighting each other. I don't think he's dead.
No, I don't either.
I don't buy that for 1 second.
No,
and either, I think Adam is foolish for believing that.
Either Brainiac has created like a Brainiac shadow or something of himself that actually came out of the Phantom Zone with Seg, or somehow, some ways, Brainiac is alive. And we'll probably see, if not next episode, the third episode, where he is back on the stage and a major player of events in this upcoming season.
And Brainiac already alluded to how irrational Seg's state of mind is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess to an extent it would make sense that Seg would convince himself that, yes, I defeated Brainiac, we can move forward, and I have to find a way to make it back to my friends and family.
Yeah, yeah. Because another thing I thought, whenever that scene, when I came upon that scene of Seg bludgeoned Brainiac to death, I mean, Brainiac, from what I recall, he has, one, he's technologically advanced. Two, he just has so many tricks up his sleeve. It's to your point, given Seg's compromised mental state, it very well could be Brainiac could have done use some trick, whether it's mental projection, even to the point where Adam is believing what Seg is seeing in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Of him beating Brainiac to death. left a clone of himself or something there. I mean, it could be any number of things. I mean, I like the idea that it is Brainiac taking advantage of Seg's mental state and maybe projecting this image of what Seg thinks he did. Because, you know, whenever Seg, right before they went to the commercial break, said, let's get this on, and they started the fight. That to me, does lend some credence to him taking advantage of Seg's mental state and being able to, make him think that he defeated him. But, that was definitely one of the, whenever they were out of the Phantom Zone and Okolu, that was definitely one of my favorite scenes of this episode as well.
Why do you think the writers chose to have them end up on Brainiac's home planet? Out of all the places that they could have gone to, why there?
I think it gives us some greater depth as far as Brainiac's character. They touch on the fact that Brainiac's people were very violent and they had wars and gives, I guess, motivations for why Brainiac does what he does. And then also just for convenience for Brainiac. If he does indeed need to go home to rehatch his scheme of basically being a world collector, obviously all the tools and things that he needs are there on his own planet.
I'm going to show my ignorance to this whole comic book situation. Correct me if I'm wrong. Brainy and Brainiac, they're technically related.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Our Brainiac 5 from Supergirl is also from Kolu.
Okay.
And if you recall, and when I was watching the episode, couldn't help but think back to Brainiac 5's scenes in the latter half of Supergirl season whenever he was captured by the Children of Liberty.
Yep. It's the second to the last episode of the season.
Yep. And how he alludes to his planet's violent and xenophobic past.
Yeah, like my mind immediately went there the moment we got the monologue from Brainiac in this episode, and I was like, okay, I just want to cross over, but oh well, we'll never get that.
But we won't. But again, as we talked about with the first season, how this show helps us appreciate Supergirl even more. It does show the wider universe and how this show could easily be related to the Arrowverse.
Well, I mean, it might already be creating its own Superman verse, considering either right after this episode aired or leading up to it, there was speculation that we might be getting a Lobo spin-off series.
Yep.
And so, I mean, the moment they ended up on that planet, I was like, oh, Lobo's around. And then we saw the douchebag warning alert go off. I think it was something else, but Will doesn't like it when I curse on this show.
Oh, I don't mind. Go ahead.
I honestly can't remember what it was.
Oh, you set it up. You're like,
but I was just waiting for it, and if they make a spinoff show, I won't be surprised, because that character's got some charisma.
Yeah, yeah. I was skeptical at first when I first saw the news report that they were considering a spinoff show, but seeing Lobo in live action. Yeah, this dude could carry. He could carry a show. He could carry a show because, for folks, many of folks are, I'm sure our listeners are familiar with Lobo, and his history as far as being a mercenary. But just to remind some people who may not be, so originally Lobo was created as a murderous villain in the Superman universe, and then he became kind of an anti-hero, and also. He was also created to sort of poke fun of Wolverine, a Punisher, and some of the Marvel characters who have similar traits. So, and that was on full display in this episode, as far as like the merc with the mouth attitude of a Deadpool, the physical savagery of Wolverine, and the swagger of the Punisher.
This may be a reference that Will does not understand, but anybody who's watched Once Upon a Time, I would compare this entrance to the entrance of Hook season 2 on Once Upon a Time, because of that damn accent. I'm a sucker. I'm a sucker for a character with an accent like that. I'm just like, yep, you keep saying dialogue. I've been listening all day. And you say the swag of the Punisher. No. Because the Punisher is like stealth, and it's not a clumsiness about it. Mm-hmm. Like, there's intention, but yeah, there's also not everything has to be perfect, which Punisher very much, I think, because of the war background, everything does have to be uniform. There's a bit of OCD in that character. True. But with this character, it's just natural swagger. I don't know. And the same swagger as Hook season 2 on Once Upon a Time.
I'll take your word for it. I haven't seen it once. I know a lot of people watch that show, but I wasn't one of them.
I watched because I found out how big of an entrance that character had, and I was real curious. Mm-hmm. And then I got suckered into it, and then I drifted off during the last few seasons. But, you know, for a good chunk of it, I was right there watching every week.
Yeah.
You know, before we move on from this talking Krypton, I do want to bring up one thing that I thought was, again, and I keep going back to this, but truly, I feel like this episode, this kickoff of season 2, like, in a nutshell, just caught me off guard. And this last bit that really did catch me off guard was how much effort was put in really making us understand that, I think, for this season, Lyta and Nyssa have really role reversed. Mm. Because last season, Nyssa and her father, they were conniving, they were playing the political game. Mm-hmm. Well, Zod and Lyta have won that game. However, yep, Lyta also has ties to the Resistance, and she's still, like, you see it in her eyes, and shout out to the actress. She did a good job in this episode where she was really cold, but you could still tell in her eyes that there was a moral conflict within her about everything she was doing for her and for her son and for her people. And Nyssa, at the same time, has gone into and fully joined the Resistance and really wanting to take care of her son, wanting to find Seg and wanting to move forward. But at the same time, she keeps getting sucked back because of her past, because of finding out that you're a clone. Well, what does that mean? Like, what kind of processing do you have to go through to fully understand, like, you're not the original, but you're still you? And so I think that there was a lot of intention in making it very clear that there's been a role reversal, though, between those two characters.
Yeah, that definitely was the case there. And, you know, thinking about Nyssa and her trying to find herself and find her new role in this world that has been built. But at the moment when Lyta killed Nyssa's father, when he was about to tell her the truth, was a really real evolutionary moment for both characters. Mm-hmm. As far as just fleshing them out and getting to the point that you made about the role reversal this season. And then Lyta's, you know, comment to her about basically, you know, he was just spin a bunch of lies to you, as I'm paraphrasing, but that was, you know, those type of reactions would have been something we would have seen probably flipped in season 1. And so I think that definitely shows some role reversal. Also, there's some growth in these characters as far as giving them something more to do and sort of help drive the narrative for this season. With Lyta in particular, and seeing her know that her role now is to basically work with Druzhod and build this new Krypton, and the Krypton that Druzhod is building is pretty much the one that we encounter when we first are introduced to Kal-El and Jor-El and when Man of Steel. I mean, just to tie that movie and the show together, she is that key lieutenant that he is using. She knows she still sees the resistance and the role that they played in season one. But I think now she is very convinced that what her son is doing is the right thing to ultimately save this world. And so she's going to do what is necessary to help him do that mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they spent a lot of the first season really focusing on the duty part of the House of Zod, and how that family line, because they're the military for Krypton, duty above all else, duty right. for the country, duty for even above your family. So I think that because they spent that season focusing on that aspect, it didn't make me, I wasn't surprised as to how Lyta came off in this first episode, mm-hmm. because I felt like if she was part of the resistance, that actually would probably not make as much sense considering what house she belongs to.
Right, right, right. And we had those scenes last season with her working with the resistance and realizing, you know, with Jaina Zod, her mother always questioning duty and to your point, how important duty is. And so, yeah, it's just a natural outgrowth of what we've seen before. And she's basically playing that role that she is destined to play.
Yeah. So again, like I'm glad the show's back. I'm glad that I'm even glad that, cause last year, I feel like Krypton came out. And then when it was starting to wrap up, Cloak and Dagger comes out. Mm-hmm. And I know a few weeks ago we were complaining because we were like, man, Cloak and Dagger is done. What are we going to watch? And yeah. Krypton swoops in and saves our summer.
It does. It does. It definitely saves our summer. I queried Sarah via DM, are you watching a particular show? She's like, nope, not even planning to. So I'm glad that Krypton so far is helping us start the summer off well.
Yeah, not to say that like the well is completely dried up, but considering the other show we're talking about, I can only watch maybe 80% of it actually, and actually be focusing on the images because half the time the show just makes me nervous and there's way too much tension for me to actually enjoy myself. And yes, I'm clearly talking about Swamp Thing because there's, you know, you put a few jump scares in the first two episodes and then Sarah suddenly does not want to ever watch the actual scene.
Oh, this week I was looking away quite a bit myself. So.
It wasn't even that scary of an episode. There was just, in the moments when Abby is like talking to her friend, I'm just like, I don't want to watch it because I'll listen to it, but I don't want to like watch it. And the next thing I know, somebody jumps out and the bug man gets her. And it's just, and you know, round of applause for the writers because they've clearly have set a tone that is unrelenting. And I don't think the show would be that there's an execution in what they're doing that even though it drives me crazy, it's very well done.
It is. It is. And yeah, it's at the end of each episode of this is the third one now. And again, it's just, I know we talked about it on our show last week as far as the cancellation and all, but it's just really, truly unfortunate that the show was canceled. And obviously we still have 7 more episodes to go, but if they continue at the pace that they're going, this is going to be one of those series that is going to be looked at like many people look at Firefly, where it was canceled too soon.
Hmm. Well, I mean, in these days with shows getting canceled, picked up by other networks, you never know what's going to happen. Everybody seems to have a second life in film and TV, especially if you can prove yourselves.
Yeah, except for The Tick, but anyway.
Well, I mean, The Tick, what, got 2 seasons?
Yeah, it did.
I mean, there's some shows like 10 years ago that if you get canceled in their first season, you don't get any second life. That's my point.
Yeah, true.
Oh, man. So in this episode, it's a slow burn, though. Mm-hmm. I have to say, they're taking their time. They're moving about as quickly as Swamp Thing moves. That just came to me. I'm so proud of myself. And, I mean, they're not holding back on the love triangle or the melodrama of it all.
Not at all. Even though they are forcing, they're still forcing the one triangle with Abby and Henderson. But, you know, I think that's going to wrap pretty soon, I believe.
I just love how in this episode they're like, well, clearly the viewers probably are a bit tired of this love triangle with Henderson, so we're gonna have the sheriff, who he's always interacting with, and she's warning him that Abby's no good. Well, apparently she and Sunderland used to have a thing.
Yep.
And I'm just like, okay, well, then again, it's a small town, you know? Beggars can't be choosers.
It's a small town. He's a rich, powerful, and even that, he's not so much a rich, powerful man. He's just a powerful bully who basically like conned his way into wealth by marrying his wife.
Which I thought was fascinating, because I didn't pick up on that prior to this episode.
No,
usually there's bigger clues, mm-hmm. and that caught me off guard, and I was like, oh, okay. So initially, you're introduced to the wife, thinking like she's the vengeful, grieving mother, but really, it's Sunderland who's playing this con game of just wanting wealth, power, and greed. You know, very much like you could probably do this a parallel between his rise and how quickly the accelerant works.
Yeah.
And how it just wrecks everything in its path.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good parallel. Very good parallel. And yeah, and how, yeah, we, I guess we did see elements of his manipulative character, especially the scene last week with, when Abby went to go visit him at the Sunderland house, but yeah, but him marrying into old money was definitely something that was a good plot twist that they executed very well.
And they are doing a good job with this whole Shauna thread, because they do it lightly. They bring her up, clearly they have to, especially whenever the mom is in on screen, because that's her big story point, grieving mother. But in this episode, I thought I was picking up on maybe Sunderland is actually the real cause for Shauna's death. And that's why in the previous episode, when Abby went to that house, he was still warm and welcoming to her. Because mm-hmm. she is like a prodigal daughter who's returning for him. And he doesn't hate her for Sean, or hate or blame her for Shauna's death. So it makes me think that, you know, if he's such a con man, maybe Shauna figured that out, because mm-hmm. we hear a little bit about Shauna and what she thinks about her father in a hallucination, would you call it? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. And so I think he might be tied to that, because we've kind of figured out she probably died in that swamp.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised now, especially considering how this episode ends, with it all coming back to Sunderland and him having even killed his own daughter to accelerate his power in this town.
Yeah, it definitely could easily be the case. He clearly is a very corrupt man, and definitely will go to any means necessary to protect what he thinks is his. And if she did discover the affair with the sheriff and was willing, you know, was going to expose it, and as a result of that, he lose everything because, you know, her mother leaving him, then yeah, I could easily see him just losing it and taking her out to the swamp or arranging for an accident to happen while she was in the swamp.
That was my initial guess. And then that final scene happened, and where he kills someone, I forget his name.
It's the banker, yeah.
The banker, and right before he decides to kill him, the banker brings up, I know about the conclave. So I wonder if it goes beyond just the affair, but it's more that she finds out about the conclave, whatever that is.
Yeah, that could be it. That was definitely a clue to something bigger. Definitely.
Yeah, because I mean, he could easily kill his wife and just like up her life insurance, and then as long as he's in the will.
maybe that's why he's worried. He's not in the will.
Well, then he's not a smart con man. Okay, we figured it out. I feel like I'm putting together about that whole storyline, I'm still a bit confused about this disease situation, especially the connection between Swamp Thing and the little girl. And we find out in this episode, because another creature is reanimated from the swamp,
right.
Bugman, will you call it? And he's fighting this creature off because he's out to get Lois Lane. Sorry, I totally didn't mean Abby. Not really. And he ends up saying, let him go, or release him. Release mm-hmm. him, I think it is.
Yeah, release him. Yep.
So what is the power? Like, what are the rules here? Because it's still very confusing for me, because we also see another swamp flu victim fall in this episode, but he doesn't seem to have a telekinesis link to Swamp Thing. So, I mean, what are the rules, Will?
I think we were starting to get some of the rules established. One, I think when Abby and Jason, were in the morgue. And they were still doing the autopsy and trying to figure out, you know, how this works. I think it's tied to Alex work as far as when he was doing his research for Sunderland, and how this is a living swamp in every meaning of the word, as far as being has a consciousness of some sort. I guess whatever to tie it to this accelerant, maybe that is what helped to create some mutations or whatever in the swamp that basically helped it become conscious. And when it picked Alec to protect it, by, you know, creating him into Swamp Thing, he is now one with the swamp and basically can, as he said, help control his actions. Because, for example, in the last episode, he did use the swamp to basically grab the guy and basically rip him apart. And then, you know, I wasn't clear if the swamp like reanimated him or if Alex grief and of you know, killing a man calls him to be reanimated. And the other thing, too, is that was very, I think the most telling thing from this episode was when whenever they did discover how the disease works as far as the swamp fighting back. And so given that obviously typically when you're trying to deal with a patient, you do pump them full of antibiotics and stuff. But once they said no, when Alex said, essentially don't fight the swamp, and Abby figures it out, whoa, we need to reverse our treatment regimen. Then things started to kind of flow and understand that these things all work together. And whatever mental link between Susie and Alec, I think it's tied to Susie's father and whatever discovery that that Woodrue actually figures out from doing the examination of his body.
I love that Woodrow and Abby had a scene in this episode. Woodrow is slowly becoming one of my favorite characters on this show. I just think that the actor is doing a really good job, and there's interest. He doesn't have the most storyline, but the way they're utilizing him, I think, is really effective. And last week we made comics, or we speculated about his relationship with his wife and what that would mean for the future, especially because in the books, it seems like he does transform into more of a bad guy in this whole storyline. Well, in this episode, there's already something wrong with her.
Mm-hmm.
There's something going on with her memory. There's which, you know, just adds to my theory. The woman is not going to make it out of season one, which means because there's no season two, she's just going to be in oblivion.
She's going to be, yeah. But to your point, something's going to happen to her, which that's going to be the catalyst that sets him over. It always does.
Well, see, it could either be that now, but now because of this scene where she forgets her pills, it's making me think, he may suddenly take note from Sunderland and want to speed up the recovery process and want to prevent her from forgetting him, prevent her from forgetting their love for one another, making him do unethical and probably a decision to use the accelerant on her. Or to protect her in a way that hasn't been tested. So I think that there's gonna be I don't know which way the writers are gonna go, but I am intrigued to figure it out and find out which way they end up going. But clearly they are setting things in motion for Woodrow to get his hands dirty.
Definitely.
What else? There was a weird scene, and I don't really know, like, why this is needed, what it has to do with the story, why everybody in this town needs to be obsessed with Abby. We encounter Daniel again, who owns the building where Alec's place, was located. And he's interacting with the seer. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm calling her.
Yeah. And I think I read somewhere her name is Xanadu.
Sure.
Yeah.
I prefer the seer.
I like the seer as well.
Swamp seer. Yeah. And she does some fortune telling. Mm-hmm. And he's now been convinced that his future success lies in making Abby fall in love with him. Did I understand what happened correctly?
I think that might be the case. I honestly, when I saw that scene, I was trying to make out what was going on there too. I really don't know. Sorry, listeners. I can't help you there.
The cards, as they say, remain unclear. Yeah. The future remains unclear.
I mean, but I guess, but I'm still trying to, but just to do, like, to your base point, what is his real purpose in this show other than basically being the outsider who's trapped in this small town and can't get out?
I forgot about him. that trope isn't working for me.
Yeah, it's just like, are we going to have some sharks show up all of a sudden and have this Sharknado meet Swamp Thing? I don't
know. Yeah. I mean, I'm just stuck on the actor and being like, really? They cast Ian Ziering as? Interesting. Also, they don't really need another character to embody that because Abby herself used to be a girl trapped in a small town wanting to get back. Nathan clearly is a character who's trapped in a small town wanting to get out, but has also set up his life there. So I don't feel like they need another one. The writers are setting up for another opportunity for Abby to find herself in some hot water and Swamp Thing to come in and save the day.
Yeah, they are. They are. But I don't think Daniel has any malevolent things towards Abby. I think he is critical, and maybe he has some knowledge. Maybe he's been around for a while, so maybe he is going to be tied to how we found out more about Shauna's death and how it ties to Mr. Sunderland and Abby. I mean, maybe he just has some deep, maybe he is that person who will help tie all these threads together. And that's probably why he is still stuck in that town.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that they are very much to flesh out this town. We're understanding motivations for why some of these people, even though Abby left, most people stay. And why is that? Especially if it's slowly but surely being invaded by a swamp.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was, I like this episode. I think I like this episode more than I did last week.
Yeah.
And, the elements that we really just went over, as long as they continue those minus Daniel, I'm sticking on board. I mean, I've seen worse things. I have a question though.
Yeah.
So prior to getting on tonight, you had me watch the Pennyworth trailer.
Yeah.
Is the Pennyworth going to be on Fox, or is it going to be on another channel, or is it going to be on the DC Universe site?
It is actually going to be on Epix. It's a cable movie channel.
Okay. Interesting. Now, will Pennyworth be tied to the new Joker movie?
Given that we've had two things now where we're starting to see more of Thomas Wayne be a focal point of the story beyond just being killed, but actually being actively engaged. So Pennyworth is set in 1960s London. So, and it obviously is focusing on Alfred as set up a security firm. So it is possible.
I bring it up because I just watching that trailer, I couldn't help but think about how similar of an aesthetic that show appears to be in comparison to the Joker trailer aesthetic. Right. Like, right. If you told me that these characters were all in the same universe, I'd be like, I buy it.
Yeah.
And I think that the person doing the cinematography for this should just continue because it's very stunning visually.
It is. Well, the cinematography and aesthetics for the Joker trailer was 1970s New York. So it's very possible that these two shows are tied. The show and the movies are tied together in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And again, given that this series is one where we're exploring Alfred as a security manager for Thomas Wayne, and what we know of the Joker movie so far, that Thomas Wayne does play a role in it. I don't know if it's pivotal or not, but definitely does play a role. They could very well be related, and it could be a lead in into it, or it could just be very independent. But I'm hoping it's your point, whereas they're somehow connected.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much Thomas Wayne we were going to get with Pennyworth, because I'd heard about this show and the way people were describing it is we're going to find out essentially what led up to Pennyworth being recruited by Thomas Wayne and how he is able to do what he does and still be a butler.
Right.
Because the man does have some skills, even in old age.
Yeah, he does. He does. And of course, in the Nolan trilogy, Alfred's background as far as being with SAS and was fleshed out more, at least live action, than it has been in other mediums. Other prior live action Batman.
Yeah, and then with this trailer, it caught me off guard because I was not expecting for them to immediately jump into, like, Pennyworth does some stuff and then instantly gets recruited by Thomas Wayne. And you start to, we're going to learn why, even after death, Pennyworth feels so tied to that family, mm-hmm. so tied to protecting that legacy, which is really intriguing. The actor who they hired to play Pennyworth, he appears to be a good, solid lead for a series.
Yeah.
He appears to be believable. They are taking the typical, I'm a pacifist. Oh, but I can hit people too. Like, I don't like violence. Oh, let me beat you up when I need to defend myself. I get kind of bored when they brought up that point. But I'm going to reserve final approval for when I see like a more thorough understanding about the chemistry between who they hired to play Pennyworth and who they hired to play Thomas Wayne. Because that chemistry, like what we're talking about with Seg and Adam, mm-hmm. that really needs to be interesting and palpable for the show to work, especially with how quickly they are pairing up those two characters.
Definitely, definitely. I will say this trailer, before I was on the, I was very meh about a Pennyworth show, but this trailer actually did its job for me in that, okay, now color me intrigued, because I am, and I think I'm going to give it a shot, see how it is.
Well, I think a lot of us were skeptical when they said, hey, let's do a show about Kal-El's great-great-grandfather all set in Krypton, because mm-hmm. that's what the people want and need.
Yeah.
And clearly they've made that work. So, yeah. You know, I watching this trailer really helped sway my opinion, and even looking at how well Krypton is doing, I'm on board. I'm more inclined to trust DC shows at this point than I am to trust DC movies.
Drop the mic.
And that's it for us tonight, people. Will, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you?
You can find me at Will M. Polk, that's WillMPolk.
And you can find me at SJ Belmont, SJBelmont. Please follow our crew on Twitter at Cena Nerd. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram. But most importantly, rate, subscribe, and comment on iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Spotify. Good night, geek out. You're welcome.